Nicholson, Reel 24.
So while the two pilots are sorting out their dollars in Lubumbashi to pay for the petrol, and Tony Carthew put aboard a case of beers, I was peering from my little airstrip into the dark blue northern sky. Certain that evening I could hear a sound of an aircraft. You know how you imagine these things, but I was certain. But I could see nothing. But then I was looking the wrong way, because it was coming from the south. And it was making a wired circle of the Cuban MiG base at Luso. Suddenly saw the plane, and I cheered. But this had the wrong effect on the unit of guards who were with us, because they thought it was a Cuban plane. They were about to shoot it down. And I ran to each of them shouting, you know, it's our plane, it's our plane. Don't shoot, don't shoot. Came slowly towards us. I mean, I should never forget the sight. White plane, coming very slowly, very low. And they did a low run over the strip to make sure they could land. There were lots of wild pig on the airstrip, and the guards had to shoot to just frighten them off. And then it circled and came in. And amazing landing, dust everywhere, stones flying everywhere. And we ran towards them. Can I read you a bit I wrote from my diary at the time? Well, what I later wrote in my diary. It only took a few moments to get aboard. Few people anywhere could ever have been in such a hurry to leave anywhere. And we were barely in our seats when we were airborne. We were exalted. We even forgot to look out of the windows to the land we had crossed and crossed again. The land we had traversed for more than 1,500 miles. The land that had been our home, our prison, and very nearly our burial place. But when I did look down, I was surprised to see it was gone. I'd lived with it so long, perhaps I thought it would never go away. Below, in the first light of the moon, I saw the broad Okavango River, shining silver, and behind it, only a shadow. The shadow that was Angola, the Angola that was already a memory. And within an hour, we had landed in Rand Airport, and Carthew sent off his coded telex to ITN in London. All chickens safely back in the nest. Well, we landed at Rand Airport just after midnight, and I was surprised to see, I suppose I shouldn't have been, a television camera and lights, and ITN had sent a camera to welcome us back, and there was Sandy Gall on the airstrip to welcome us back with a large bottle of champagne. But in the way of things, ITN had forgotten to tip Diana know that we were out and that we'd landed. So the first that she knew was a knock on the front door. And I must have looked aside, because I said I'd lost 2.5 stone and my ribs were showing. And I was still in my dirty shorts with just a tattered shirt and a huge beard and hair down to my shoulders. I looked like, the wild man of Borneo, or worse. And I remember trying to say, what do you want? And early the next morning, I mean, we kind of kissed and cuddled, and and then Diana said, well, where are the crew? And I said, well, they've gone back to their house to have their party. She said, well, we can't go to bed now. I mean, we've got to join them. So we jump into the car, and we go around to the crew's house, which is about a mile and a couple of miles away. And as we got out, I could hear this music, this loud music. And I thought, man, having a party already, I couldn't believe it. You know, they just landed and there was a party going. I knew they were, you know, boisterous lads, but so I looked through the window, one end of the room, peered through the window, and there was Mickey, absolutely naked, gyrating about, dancing with a bottle of wine, you know, pouring a bottle of wine over himself. Crept down the other end, and there was Tom, absolutely stark as again, gyrating to the music, drinking, you know, lagers faster than anyone ever could. And I walked in with Diana, and there they were just dancing together, yeah, absolutely naked, with Sandy Gore sitting, you know, in the middle of them, drinking. And they had a small swimming pool. So we all rushed out, and we just dived into this swimming pool. And I suddenly realized that in my pocket was my passport. You know, the one thing that I'd carried with me and had kept sacrosanct, you know, sacred it was. Because if ever I was caught, that was the one thing that would keep me alive. And I'd kept it dry despite all the... And here I jumped into a swimming pool and had ruined it. The next morning, I was in my own bed. Two little boys kind of crept in, one age 5 and one age 6, to inspect this very odd figure that was showing through the twisted duvet. I felt a little finger dabbing my dirty legs, and another was stroking my beard. I remember Tom saying, it's got sand in its ear. And old William, in his usual grumpy voice, saying, he's got toenails like a chicken. Is it really, Daddy? Well, they weren't convinced. But then, as I said to Dan later, 4 months is a long time in a little boy's life. It certainly was. There we are, that's Angola.
Came out of Angola in terms of reports and films, you know, having gone through 110 days?
Well, our camera was worked until, our batteries lasted. I mean, it was, how many, 2.5 months, was it, until, I forget exactly how long, certainly a couple of months before we met Savimbi. And surprisingly, our camera batteries lasted that time. But they do, if in heat, they last much longer. And if you leave them out in the sun, the batteries kind of keep their charge. So we actually got the interview with Savimbi that we'd gone for. It would have been, you know, absolute disaster if we'd turned up and the batteries, camera batteries weren't working. But they lasted long enough for me to do the interview, and then they went fut. But we had a wind-up camera, a mechanical camera. So from then on, our journey leaving Savimbi and trying to get out was recorded on this wind-up camera, which is perfectly okay. No sound, which was a shame, but there you are. Filming, you know, once we were desperate to get out, filming was not our main priority. I mean, we filmed incidentally when we felt like it, and we didn't often feel like it. Our main concern was just to get safely out of the place. So the film report, I sent over, I think, a 12 or 13 minute report on the a few days following our release, and that went out on ITN. I saw it the other day for the first time in 20 odd years, and I obviously never wrote a script. I just kind of ad-libbed it as I went along. We were pretty shell-shocked by that time, you know. The last thing I really wanted to do after 4 months in the bush was to sit down and write about it. All I wanted to do was get on holiday with my family. So that was a long report. But of course, since then, I've been back to Angola quite a few times, partly to report the war, but mostly to report the side effects of war. The starvation, the mines. I mean, there's millions of mines there. And the British efforts, like the Halo Trust, to raise mines, raise awareness of mines, and also to teach Angolans themselves how to clear mines. So that has been most of my stories. Of course, as we talk, which is now, you know, end of February 2002, we've just heard that Savimbi has been killed. And I've seen the photographs in the newspaper. There's no doubt that it's him. And without Savimbi, UNITA will collapse. I mean, it was divided anyway. It's only he that kept it together, and towards the end, I gather, he was pretty brutal in his methods of keeping his party together. With him gone, unity will collapse, and maybe for the first time in 30-odd years, there'll be the war will end and there'll be peace. And then, of course, I mean, I'm going back to Angola in a few months' time for the Back to the Front series, and we'll see more precisely the devastation, not only of the cities, but of the villages and of the people. Because there's at least a million people who have been just travelling around Angola, especially in the south, trying to avoid the war, displaced people and starving people. So it's going to be an eye-opener to go back and see the devastation mostly caused by Savimbi, because he had the chance. And I think it was 88... he had the chance, and actually put his name, signature to a piece of paper which kind of ended the war, and he was offered, I think he was offered the deputy presidency, which is a pretty generous offer, and he could have had seats in the assembly. I mean, he could have entered politics, and he might even have displaced Dos Santos eventually, simply by political manoeuvring rather than, you know, keeping the civil war going. So he started out really as the West's, eventually the West's champion, and eventually was left with no friends because he just simply wanted to win by force, wanted to win by war. So sad thing to say, but it really is good riddance.
You had a relatively positive opinion of him early on, didn't you?
Oh yes, I think most people did. Most people who met him were very impressed by him. I think I mentioned it earlier that he was a doctor of philosophy and etc. from Lausanne University, but I gather that's been questioned since. That in fact he may not have been such an academic. The fact is he spoke very good English, Portuguese, French, and you know, he was a force for good. At least in Western eyes, because we didn't want Angola to become another Marxist state, an offshoot of Cuba, under the direct guidance of the Moscow Institute, Africa Institute in Moscow. So, yeah, he was fighting against communism, as people in the 70s, in Asia especially, were fighting against communism. And, yes, we thought he was jolly good news. But like another famous favourite of ours, Robert Mugabe, things went very wrong, very sour, and the men he became, Savimbi, like Mugabe, became a tyrant.
How long did South Africa continue to support him? Had you any idea, you know, whether this was covert or otherwise?
South Africa, as I explained to you earlier, once we blew the story that they were in there, the Tiger Battalion turned around, and I think they were only about 50 miles, 60 miles away from Luanda. The idea was that the South Africans would win the war up to Luanda and then pull back and let Savimbi march in as if he had won the war. But of course, our story blew all that apart. The South Africans continued covert operations there. And of course pushed the Savimbi line throughout their embassies in the world. But in the end, when Savimbi got hold of the diamond mines, he could afford to buy his own weapons, and the army became far more modern, and no doubt he was getting lots of intelligence information from the South Africans, but they, to my knowledge, no longer participated. I'm sure they had some advisors in and out, and I think Savimbi quite often used South Africa to get out in order to travel to the United States and all the rest of it.
How about the Cubans? What was known about their support for the government side?
Well, we knew the Cubans were in there. I mean, there were thousands of Cuban soldiers, Cuban pilots. I mean, Savimbi's, the MPLA didn't have any pilots of their own, so all the pilots flying the MiGs and the helicopters were either Cuban or sometimes East German, but I think mostly Cuban. No, the Cubans had a very strong presence. People who went to Luanda said that, you know, the place was cluttered with Cuban soldiers. And do remember that at Cabinda, which is in northern Angola, it's a little kind of strip of land between Zaire and Angola, which is where the oil wells are. And, you know, the Americans, one of the, the ironies of the war was, whereas the Americans were supporting Savimbi in his fight against the MPLA, the Cubans, who were fighting for the MPLA, were also helping to defend Cabinda for the Americans. The Americans, you know, could not have survived there. The oil installations would have suffered. But, you know, here you have a communist guard on an American oil installation complex. Now, the Cubans were there, in as you know, by their thousands. But as far as I remember reading, it was the last place on earth that the Cuban soldier wanted to go to. And they weren't pleased to be there. And I know there was an awful lot of civil unrest back in Cuba about the casualties. Why are we fighting a war in Africa? It's got nothing to do with us, you know. But Fidel Castro wanted to support, with Russia's urging, wanted to support a communist African state.
You were saying earlier on that you were the head of the ITN Bureau in South Africa at that time. When did that start, Michael? When did you first go to South Africa?
I first went to South Africa in 73. Now, there were no resident foreign correspondents in South Africa. I think Reuters may have had some of the news, but I think none of the newspapers had residents. So they had freelancers, stringers who supplied stories. And certainly there were no television stations there. They were very strict about it. But of course, once television came to South Africa, I think in 1970, 71, I forget exactly when, but as soon as South Africa had television and opened up SABC, they allowed foreign nets to come in. Much later, I went in 73, covertly. I went in as a tourist, as most people did. You went in as a tourist, and then before they found you out, you got your story. You had to find a local cameraman who was willing to risk being deported or having his license taken away. So you did it very, very secretively. And carried the film out with you. But in the end, I think in 1974, they kind of lifted the bans, and in 75 to 76, following the Soweto riots, ITN decided to open up a bureau there. The other reason, of course, was Rhodesia. We were backwards and forwards to Rhodesia, and I went to the editor, Nigel Ryan, and said, look, this is ridiculous. Well, you know, it's a huge story, the Soweto riots, it's the beginning of the Black Revolution. It's going to get worse. We can't just keep going in and out. We must establish a bureau there. And so we applied, and the South Africans, much to my surprise, said yes. And we were the first television bureau to open up. This is the BBC, followed a couple of months later, and then in came the Americans one by one. Because the anniversary of the Soweto riots in 76 was almost as bloody as the original ones. The odd thing was, and we were transmitting all our stories out of SABC if we were satelliting them. We didn't always satellite them. In those days, and remember we were filming in those days, you usually shipped your film. You shot your story, put it in a shipping bag, and you gave it to a shipping agent, and it caught the 6:15 flight out of British Airways flight out of Jan Smuts Airport every night, and was in London the next morning. So London was getting the news the day after, unless it was a massive story, and we would then satellite it from the South African Broadcasting Corporation. Very expensive thing to do in those. It was about £2,000 a time. So that's how we operated. There was no censorship. We were on a six-monthly renewable visa. So if they didn't like you, then the visa wasn't renewed, and there were one or two people who fell foul of the authorities and were told to leave. I managed to stay out there for over 4 years, having my visa renewed every 6 months, and I don't think I was unduly sympathetic to the apartheid regime. You couldn't be. I mean, if you were sympathetic to it, it meant you were out of a job, because London were not at all sympathetic. But I did try and be fair. I tried to be as level-headed as I could be in my reports. You didn't have to opinionate. You didn't have to give an opinion, because the pictures were there for people to judge themselves. Some reporters, including a couple of television reporters, were deported. We had one in ITN. He was deported. John Simpson was deported, because they felt it necessary to add their own comments. I remember one of our own guys was thrown out because he called the South African government obscene, which was not necessary. It was enough simply to report the brutality of the regime in picture form, to show this is it. You know, white policemen whipping blacks, the torture, the suicides, the imprisonments, the black demonstrations. It was enough simply to show those pictures. You didn't have to put any comment on them. They were comment enough. But some people overdid it. I found the South African authorities very fair. It was what I call retrospective censorship. They never asked to see your film, never asked to see your scripts. You sent it, and it was monitored by the South African Embassy in London. If they didn't like it, they would send a report back to the Ministry of Information in Pretoria, and then you'd be hauled over the coals. If it was bad enough to be deported, then you were deported. I had very few queries on my reports. And I say that because at the other end, at the London end, there were three or four South Africans working for ITN. And I remember when I opened the bureau, they said to me quite pointedly, we'll be watching you. So, you know, the censors, in a way, were at the London end rather than the South African end. And I said to them, right, you know, you watch me. And if I go wrong, I'm sure you'll tell me. And in the 4 years I reported out of Africa, they never reprimanded me. So I think I played it fair at both ends. Something you can do if you try hard enough. If you try too hard, and you know, then you fall foul of one end or the other.
Would you have been there at the time of the death of Steve Biko?
Yes, I was there at the death. Biko was made to be too large, I think. He wasn't as important as some people suggested, including Donald... what's the name of the... I'll start again. Biko was, I think, overwritten, overplayed. He was a good man. He was a Christian. He believed in nonviolence, he was he was a big man to a small number of people. If you follow me, he didn't feature large in black politics. Some white journalists made a lot of him because, you know, they were looking for a black hero following the riots. And, you know, he was attempting to win the Gandhi way, passive non-resistance. But certainly he never featured much in the news until his death. And as you know, he was arrested and brutally beaten up. And during that beating up, they fractured his skull and he died. They denied it, of course. The South African denied all knowledge of it and said that he had died of a heart attack. In fact, they said he died on hunger strike, and then they said he died of a heart attack. But my cameraman, Fred Ogredis, actually got the only shot, a picture of Biko in his coffin at the, as he called, Christina Mundi Church in Soweto, the big church in Soweto. And there he was in the coffin with this huge gash across his forehead into his skull that crushed his skull. And that was the proof. So that was, if Biko featured large in my reports, it was that once and only time when we got the proof that Biko had been beaten to death. But, you know, his death passed off with demonstrations, but then the memory of Biko disappeared very fast because the black African, the black South African, you know, simply wasn't prepared for passive resistance. They realised that it was a cul-de-sac for them. There was only one way that they could win, and that was by the demonstrations, violent demonstrations.
What did you think of the sort of white reaction? You know, was there a lot of complacency during the 1970s? I believe South Africa was quite booming then, wasn't it?
Oh, South Africa was booming, despite the sanctions, you know, were meaningless. It had its own oil, had its diamonds, had its gold. People wanted all three. It was self-sufficient, terribly inventive people, just like the Rhodesians. And, you know, after the anniversary of the Soweto riots, 76, 77, things quietened down. And the major story from then on, for me anyway, was Rhodesia. The politics of South Africa, the violence that we expected from the blacks, what we thought in 75, 76 was going to be the black revolution, the beginning of the end, it never materialized. Somehow the South Africans managed to contain it. And oddly enough, from about 1980 onwards, there was hardly a story coming out of South Africa. It seemed to quieten down. So from 77 onwards, I spent most of my time, most of my reporting, in Rhodesia, which was the massive British story, of course. The war that was going on between Mr. Smith's UDI regime and Mugabe's ZANU-PF and Joshua Nkomo's ZAPU. One operating from the Mozambique border and Nkomo operating from the Zambian border. So that was the new story. And of course, it was a story that mattered more to the British viewer than what was happening in South Africa.